Breathe on us, breath of God. Fill us with your inspiration, with your peace, your words. Guide our response so that your word doesn't just stay in our minds, but lives in our hearts and in every fiber of our being, and comes out in our actions and in our speaking and in our choices. Amen. Many of you are likely familiar with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's model that she came up with to describe the stages of grief. She says, anyone going through grief usually experiences at least two of the following: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. She says this is true whether you're living with a terminal illness, some sort of catastrophe, a personal loss of job or income or relationship or freedom. This could be a life event, a death of someone you love, an addiction, the onset of an illness, any tragedy or disaster. She says these steps don't necessarily come in order. Sometimes they all pile on at once. You may go through a few and come back and experience them again. Often they kind of hit us in this roller coaster effect. We switch back and forth between depression and bargaining and anger and denial. But these are the stages often we go through when we are working through some form of grief. And in this passage, we see Jesus grieving. We see his human love of his dear friend. He gets the word of the illness and later death of his dear friend, and we see Jesus weeping and raging in his grief. Verse 35 of John 11 is the favorite of a lot of Bible drillers. Jesus wept. It says that a man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the brother of Mary and Martha. The same Mary that we hear studying at Jesus' feet, the same Martha who was often in the kitchen, they sent word to Jesus saying, the one you love so very much is sick. They don't explicitly request that he come to the house because they know that he will. Given their relationship, their closeness, because this family was dear to Jesus' heart. They were the kind of family that you choose. We all know we have family that we're born with and then the family that we acquire. And this is the family that Jesus acquired. He loved them. And it was kind of an unusual family. Mary, the one who abandons all social decorum and cultural boundaries to throw herself without reserve at Jesus' feet, either with perfume or to learn. Martha, this capable hostess and homemaker, maybe to a fault. Lazarus is kind of the silent partner of the three. We don't know him for any particular deed. We know him as the one that Jesus loved. We know that he was sick. In some ways, we know what happened to Lazarus, not what Lazarus did. When Jesus experienced the sisters, Mary and Martha, weeping, oops, goodness, I turned two pages at once. This family accepted Jesus. Theirs was the home that he went to whenever he was near Jerusalem. It was about a 20-minute walk or so from Jerusalem. It was kind of the suburbs of Jerusalem at that time. And Jesus would stay at their house, and they were kind of his home base of operations, particularly during his final weeks of life. He would go into Jerusalem, and then he would come back often and stay at their house. And they opened their home to them, to Jesus, even when it was clear that it put themselves at risk. It had already been announced that to associate with Jesus would mean that one would be expelled from the synagogues and also the temple. And yet this family continued to welcome Jesus into their home with whatever the consequences were. And so this was the family that sent word to Jesus saying, Lord, your dear friend is very sick. And it says in verse 5, although Jesus loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus, he stayed where he was for the next 2 days and didn't go to them. And then finally, after these days passed, he said to his disciples, "Let's go to Judea again." And we have to wonder, why in the world would Jesus wait? Why would he put them through this grief that perhaps wouldn't have been necessary if he had just come sooner? How in the world can illness or death ever be part of the glory of God? And this narrative doesn't answer those questions. This gospel walks us through the face of death and grief and reminds us that this is a part of every one of our lives. You know, a lot of times when we pray, we wish that God would answer our prayers in the three-point format that we have probably laid it out in. God, here's what's on my heart, and here's what you can do to fix it in bullet points. And rarely does God respond in the ways that we might imagine. And as a child, I was always taught that God always answers our prayers with either a yes, a no, or a wait. But often it doesn't manifest in the ways or in the time frames that we would desire. In verse 8, Jesus' disciples warn him against going back. So we understand now that there's some personal risk to Jesus if he goes back to Bethany, where they live, and closer to Jerusalem. And they say in verse 8, "Surely you will be killed if you go back." And Jesus knew that if he went to go see his friends, it would set in motion a string of actions that would ultimately lead to his own death. He knew that if he went back, it would change the already changed lives of this family. It would throw them into the limelight, possibly endangering them by their association with him. You know, throughout John's gospel, we see Jesus moving in his own time. And again, how often do we wish that God would operate by our calendar and not God's own? And when Jesus does arrive there, he finds that his friend has been in the tomb for 4 days. And Mary and Martha were no different than any one of us now. They were frustrated that Jesus didn't show up when he could have saved their brother. Didn't they understand? They sent the message days ago. Why didn't he come when he could have made a difference? Didn't he love them? Didn't he love Lazarus? Why didn't he come sooner? Now, it could be that as single women, Mary and Martha were dependent on their brother, not only for financial support, but for their independence. A loss of Lazarus might have meant more than just the pain of losing a brother. But how many of us have cried out in our grief, "God, where are you? Where were you? I prayed and you didn't show up. I didn't see you in that moment when I needed you. Why didn't you do something?" Because we can't always see God's bigger picture. We see the peace that we're in, and we suffer sometimes not knowing what the bigger picture is. They called Jesus, expecting him to come as one who loved Lazarus and loved them. And they expected Jesus to behave in a manner in keeping with that love, and he doesn't come when they expected him. He doesn't even show up for the funeral. And when the sisters get word that Jesus is finally on his way, Martha, she's pretty much a hothead, she runs out to meet him. And that would have been kind of scandalous behavior for a woman at that time. And she runs at Jesus with all the depths of her grief and her anger. And she confronts him. Couldn't this whole tragedy have been prevented in the first place? Couldn't Jesus have healed Lazarus, who he loved? Look at all these other people that you healed, Jesus, and you don't even know them. You took care of them, and here's one that's your best friend. You know, if anything, this text reminds us that being faithful, that being a believer, doesn't inoculate us from grief. It doesn't mean that we'll never suffer. We may all have a beeline to the divine, but that doesn't mean that God is going to do exactly what we ask. There is no one on this earth whose righteousness or hard work or good planning will keep them from suffering. Bad things do happen to good people. And it's no less a fact for Jesus being present. Being a follower of Jesus doesn't make us immune to grief. When her brother Lazarus took sick, Mary asked Jesus for help. But Jesus delayed so that by the time he arrived there, Lazarus had been in the grave for 4 days. Martha cried to Jesus, "If you had been here, my brother would not have died." Mary, her sister, said the exact same thing in verse 32. "Lord, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died." And amidst all the grief and all the tears, the neighbors start mumbling their own asides.
"Well, I heard he opened the eyes of a blind man. He couldn't even help his friend when he was sick.
Couldn't he have prevented all of this?" And Jesus doesn't answer their question. So often we hit God with all these questions. And throughout his ministry, people would ask Jesus all these questions. And often his response was not the answer to those questions, but instead to say, "You need better questions." Jesus doesn't answer their questions. Instead, in this shortest verse in the Bible, he reveals part of himself and of the heart of God. Jesus wept. He experienced their grief and shared in it. He was deeply moved. Ours is not some remote sky God that doesn't care that we hurt. Jesus, in this passage, sits and weeps with them. Joy Yee has written that we don't always know why God does things the way that God does. But this passage shows us that it's all right to grieve and to mourn. We know that the Bible promises that eventually everything will be put right. But until then, we live in these in-between times where that has not yet come to pass. So how do we live in this now but not yet time when we're waiting for that to manifest? What do we do in the in-between times when we're still waiting for these reunions with the ones that we loved, when we're still waiting for the wounds and the scars that we carry around from past hurts to be healed? What do we do while we're waiting to stop fighting with God and with ourselves? What do we do when we don't have to put so much effort into doing the right thing and choosing the good way? What do we do in these in-between times? And we see this example of Jesus as he approaches Lazarus's tomb, because we realize that he was in a liminal space there as well. It's at a moment when Jesus knows that every step closer to his friend's home means closer step to his own death and the end of his own life. And even though he will rise again, just as he will resurrect Lazarus, that in no way negates the pain and the suffering and the dying that they walk through. Often we want to skip right over all of Holy Week and just jump right to Easter morning. But there's a lot of hardship that comes before we ever get to that place. And one of the things that Jesus does in that in-between place is to weep. You know, no matter how sure we are of God's promises and how strong our hopes are, we as God's people can still be moved to tears. When John says that Jesus was deeply moved and troubled, the words there, the literal translation is that Jesus groaned violently and was shaken to the depths of his being. Weeping is not a lack of faith. Mary and Martha and Jesus wept at their grief. Whether we find ourselves at the passing of a loved one or witnessing some injustice or hearing terrible news, we can find ourselves in a place of mourning and in tears. Jesus knew that he had the power to raise his friend. He knew that Lazarus was with God, and yet he still wept because he missed him. He felt the pain of that time. You know, we live with hope toward the future, but this is the reality that we live in right now. There are some situations that are beyond our control, beyond our power to help. There's some suffering that we cannot alleviate, and sometimes the best that we can do is to be empathetic in those moments, to not numb ourselves to the pain. That doesn't help either. There's a little girl who was supposed to be home, and she wasn't back yet. She stayed out much later than she was supposed to. And when she got home, her mother scolded her and said, "Where have you been? You were supposed to be home 2 hours ago." The little girl said, "I know, but I was playing with my friend and she dropped her doll and it broke. And I was helping her." Her mother said, "You were helping her fix her doll for 2 hours?" The little girl said, no, I couldn't help her fix it, but I could sit with her and help her cry. There is something in that. In moments of grief, frankly, there's nothing you can say that's very helpful. There's a lot that you can say that isn't helpful, but your presence alone is powerful. I have a dear friend who's an activist, a community organizer, and there was a terrific tragedy in the community that we lived in, and she had gone and she was just sitting with the families who had suffered this event, and she called me and she said, I don't know what to do. I need to help, and I don't know what to do. I said, what have you been doing? She said, I've just been sitting here all day with these women crying. I said, that's what you're supposed to do. She said, no, I need to like organize some people and get up and have a petition or a coalition. I said, settle down. Your job is to sit with them. And it was very difficult because that's not how she was made. But sometimes that's what we're called to do, is to sit with someone when they're hurting, to not try to give them right answers, to not try to make it better, and to gloss over their pain, to be present with them and let them be raw and real and say, yeah, this hurts. Jesus wept. He wept over the death of his friend. He wept over the obtuseness of human hearts and minds. He wept over Jerusalem. He wept with individual people and for individual people. You know, but there are times when weeping alone isn't all that we can do. Ecclesiastes says there is a time for tears and a time to refrain from tears. After our tears, we have to continue to move, lest we become immobilized and stuck in our grief. It says in verse 17 that when Jesus arrived, Lazarus had been in the tomb for 4 days. And at that time, there was a belief that after about 3 days, the soul would depart from the body. Up until that point, the understanding was that the soul kind of lingered near the body. But once the body began to stink, the soul said, no, that's not my place anymore, and would depart. And 4 days had passed. And Martha heard Jesus was coming, ran out to meet him, and Mary stayed in the house. In verse 21, Martha says, Master, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. Even now, though, I know that whatever you ask, God will give you. And Jesus said, your brother will be raised up. And Martha answered, I know that he will be raised up in the resurrection at the end of time. Martha hears this almost as a platitude. And Jesus answers in verse 25, you don't have to wait for the end. I am the resurrection and the life. And anyone who believes in me, even though they die, will live. And anyone who lives believing in me ultimately doesn't die at all. Do you believe this? And she says, yes. All along I've believed you're the Messiah, the Son of God who's come into the world. And after this, it says in verse 28 that she went to her sister Mary and whispered in her ear, the teacher is here and is asking for you. And the moment she heard that, Mary jumped up and ran out to meet him. Jesus hadn't yet entered the town, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. And when their friends saw Mary run off, they followed after her, thinking that she was on her way to the tomb. And Mary came to where Jesus was waiting and fell at his feet, saying, Master, if only you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. Verse 33 says that when Jesus saw her sobbing and the people with her sobbing, a deep anger welled up within him. And he said, where did you put him? And they said, come and see. And Jesus wept. And the people said, look how deeply he loved him. But others said, well, if he loved him so much, why didn't he do something to keep him from dying? After all, he opened the eyes of a blind man. And then Jesus, with the anger welling up again inside of him, arrived at the tomb. And it was a simple cave in a hillside with a slab of stone laid against it. And Jesus said, roll the stone away. And Martha, the sister of the dead man, said, by this time, Jesus, there'll be a stench. He's been in there 4 days. And Jesus looked at her and said, didn't I tell you if you believed, you would see the glory of God? And then to the others, he said, go away, remove the stone. And they rolled it away. And Jesus raised his eyes to heaven and prayed, Abba God, I know that you listen to me. But on account of this crowd, I'm speaking so that they may believe that you sent me. And Jesus shouted, "Lazarus, come out." And the name Lazarus means God is my help. So help me, God. Lazarus, come out. And Lazarus came out, bound in his grave clothes with his face wrapped in a headcloth. And Jesus told them, "Unwrap him and let him go." You know, it's interesting, when Jesus raised Lazarus up, he gave other people work to do. You roll away the stone. You help him out of those grave clothes. Often doing things for others in the midst of our grief is the healthiest thing that we can do to move beyond that place of being stuck. Now, God seems to always be like this, seeking human cooperation in accomplishing God's purposes. You know, God doesn't have to do it like this, but God chooses to involve us. Jesus told his disciples and us to follow him, to love as he loved, to weep, to rejoice, to serve, to lay down our lives. And we are invited to join in God's work, to be a part of the church and the world, and to help roll away stones and to unbind people who are tied in things that would drag them down into death or loneliness or fear or failure. We don't raise people to new life. God does this, but God lets us help. So in these in-between times, we live with hope for what is to come, but we live in this present reality. I was out working in the yard last week when we had that minute of nice weather, remember? And I saw this snail kind of climbing up one of our fruit trees, and I looked at it. All of a sudden, I hear all these birds, and they start teasing him. "You dumb snail, what are you doing? That tree doesn't even have any buds on it. What are you doing? Dumb snail, why are you doing climbing up there?" And I thought the birds were being a little snarky, but they had a point. They're just now starting to bud out just a little bit. And that snail just kept going, paid nobody any mind, and said, "Well, by the time I get there, there'll be some fruit." You know, we have to keep on this path in the in-between, even if it looks crazy, even if we have folks calling us out and doubting us. We have to hold on to something that we can intuit but haven't yet seen. Jesus walked into Jerusalem not long after raising Lazarus and continued steadily into the heart of conflict, seeing beyond the false accusations into suffering and abandonment, knowing that although death hurts unbelievably, it isn't ever the end. It doesn't get the last word. He walked through the world as it was, seeing the one that could be. God doesn't just empathize with us, God also acts. Jesus wept with his friends and raised Lazarus from the dead. You know, God doesn't always act in the times and places that we would imagine, but we can trust that God will act. We can hope even while we cry out of our depths to God. We cannot stay in a place of despair. Winter doesn't last forever, and this darkness has its rightful place within us, but we cannot always live there because ultimately we are a resurrection people. Easter is coming. However painful our current circumstances, our present agony or grief, we can trust that God has both the first and the last word. Rinpoche says that when we finally know that we're dying and all other sentient beings are dying with us, we start to have this burning, almost heartbreaking sense of the fragility and preciousness of every moment and every being. And from this grows a deep, clear, limitless compassion for all. It was this compassion that moved Jesus to tears. But this compassion can't live in isolation. We must link our compassion with moving beyond into action. I don't know what touches your heart to turn your heart to tears or even into anger. Maybe it's the ongoing struggles in Syria or South Sudan or South Providence. It may be the wars of religious hatred or starvation in a world of plenty. But there does come a time that we, in the midst of our tears, can no longer remain stricken and still. We, like Lazarus and those around him, have work to do, stones to roll away, and grief to endure, and life to live. Beloved, it is all right to weep and to mourn, but don't get stuck there. Let this move you to a place where you can again come alive and bring God's heaven closer to God's earth. Amen.